Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Francis. I'm a host on the New Books Network, and today I have with me Alejandro Nava, a professor of religious studies at University of Arizona. Alejandro, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
So I really enjoyed reading your book. It was one of my favorite books I've read in a while, actually. And I'm wondering how you came to write this book.
Thank you for saying that. That means a lot to me. I think that I've, over the years, I've been teaching a class on hip hop and religion at the University of Arizona for many years. Like, I can't believe this, but it's been like from the early 2000s. So I think throughout that time, I've developed and grown a lot. And I think one of the challenging things for academics is, you know, once it's really hard to lose some of the habits and customs of academic writing, especially when you're trained in graduate school. And I think over the course of those years, I've been trying to write more creatively, bring a little bit more of myself into the picture. And so I, in many ways, I think like I've kind of been moving in that direction. But I owe it a lot to my students. I really think I have it in mind, even though I still love ideas. I love academic discussions and conversations, but I always have it in my mind that I want to be able to speak to my students. And I want a general audience I want my writing to be accessible and creative. So I think that was a hope of mine that it's again, not to say that I don't find academic life intellectually stimulating and exciting and creative. But there's also limitations on the style and the form of a lot of academic writing, and that I was trying to move away from to an extent. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say your book definitely has a relevance that a lot of academic writing doesn't have. How did you get interested in hip hop, and have you always been interested in religion?
Yeah, so it's an interesting, I grew up listening to hip hop. I would actually have to say, I've been thinking about it a lot lately, that I really was the first to graduate from college in my family. I'm from Tucson, Arizona, Mexican-American family. And I was the first to graduate. So I really didn't grow up surrounded by books. I would honestly have to say that some of the rappers were the first to kind of introduce me to the magic of language, of words, the power of poetry, of rhyming, and the extraordinary creativity of what was coming out of the mouth of a lot of MCs in the 80s and 90s and then into the 2000s. So I grew up listening to it. Actually, my brother was a B-boy, and his breaking crew would compete throughout the city in Tucson. And they were extraordinarily like creative, and it was like an exciting group. There was one that was more of a rapper. Another one, most of them, you know, would they're both B-boys and B-girls. There were two women in the crew, and it was mainly a collective of Black and Mexican kids. And I just remember how exciting it was in a lot of ways. There was a rapper, and they had somebody, they didn't have anybody doing graffiti writing. That was one thing that was lacking. But you know, they had all of these things. And I just remember following my brother around and marveling at the dances and at the routines. And then particularly at the inventiveness of some of the rappers, both in his group, but also obviously what I was hearing on the radio. What I'm saying is, I think I'd have to say that rap was really the first to captivate me, the art of language and the richness of the slang and the street idioms and all of that, I think was very exciting to me. Now, I also had a very strong interest in social justice issues. I had an interest in religion that developed, and I decided to go to graduate school to pursue religious studies. I was particularly interested in Latin American religion, and especially some of the movements called liberation theology that was coming out of the developing countries, especially in Latin America. But I saw it really kind of in my own life here in Tucson, that in the later 80s, the sanctuary movement was part of I was aware of it. I was too young to be fully involved, but I was aware of it. And I remember hearing a lot about the churches that were basically providing sanctuary for a lot of refugees fleeing very violent circumstances. And that was really kind of triggered something in me that had lasting consequences. And really, I'd have to say that redirected the course of my life. So, because I was actually an undergraduate at the University of Arizona. So I'm fortunate enough to return as a professor. I have to say that, you know, that the sanctuary movement and a lot of those social justice struggles of the late 80s and the 90s were very formative influences on my life. And again, kind of running parallel to hip hop in many ways, I thought that hip hop was also tackling social issues, although I never thought that my academic studies and hip hop would merge. I always saw them differently. So I ended up in graduate school at the University of Chicago. And I remember, again, I was pursuing basically like studies in philosophy of religion and Latin American religion. And I stumbled into this lecture on, I think it was advertised as something like God and hip hop. And I was like absolutely fascinated because I loved hip hop, but again, it was like a private interest. I didn't see it connecting with my studies at the time. So I didn't know who he was, but it turns out it was Michael Dyson. I didn't know at the time who this professor was, but I was blown away by the lecture. It was on, you know, exploring religious elements of hip hop. And this was probably somewhere, I vaguely have a memory of it, but it was like in the mid-90s. So it was a very exciting lecture. And so when I got a faculty position in the early 2000s at the University of Arizona, I right away I thought I wanted to create a class on religion and hip hop, and they allowed me to do it, and it's been really an exciting journey teaching the class at Arizona.
Great. So let's now jump into the content of the book. So in the first chapter, you write that we need musical and theological vocabularies that can capture both transcendence and earthiness, purity and sin, sublimity and banging, sublimity and the banging cacophonous noise of the streets. We need hip-hop's low end frequencies to anchor us in the dirt and grime of the world. And that's a theme that you come back to in all of the chapters, the anchorage to the corporeal and physical, or even the locality of the world rather than something ephemeral and infinite, or I guess in addition to something ephemeral and infinite. Why is this anchorage an important aspect of a living and a vital religion?
Yeah, that's such an important question, and it does run throughout my book. You're so right. I think that especially the perception of theology, the perception that a lot of people have is that it's obsessed with questions of transcendence and otherworldliness, and that can have a tendency to neglect the physical and corporeal, sensual aspects of human experience. And I think what's remarkable about the culture of hip hop, I think I point this out throughout the study, that of course hip hop is deeply flawed. I mean, there are many problems with it. I'm not dogmatic about it. Like, I don't, you know, see hip hop as like free from ambiguity, and has definitely some troubling aspects. But I really do think that it was a really powerful art form that gave the mic to young Black and Brown youth, and then eventually like marginalized youth throughout the world, eventually. The disenfranchised groups in so many countries, I point that out, like even in Russia, like disenfranchised kids picking up hip hop to be a voice of dissent and opposition. So I think that it gave the mic to these kids and allowed them to kind of express themselves, their joys, their struggles, their disappointments, their discontent with life as it is in parts of the inner city. So there was an aspect of reportage, like of being a voice of from the ground level. And I think that is something that can be extraordinarily valuable to the field of religious studies, especially like, as I was suggesting earlier, the way in which religious studies and theology tends to be confined to intellectual conversations and academic contexts or ecclesiastical contexts. And I think the danger is of betraying some of the struggles of, you know, of marginalized and unseen groups in society that conversations of theology, religious studies would just occur in the universities. And so I think hip hop like brings it down to earth, so to speak, and that really can provide an insight life in the corners of the modern world, in the peripheries of the modern world. And I think that's one thing I really emphasize, that that's actually really true to the spirit of the biblical tradition. The biblical tradition in Judaism, Christianity, including Islam, has this like focus in both the Bible and in theological texts of being a voice of, especially the prophetic tradition, the prophets, being a voice of the marginalized, the oppressed, the impoverished. And so I think in that sense, I often tell my class that I know we, in our day and age, we tend to think of like social justice concerns in a totally secular way. But if you look at the biblical tradition, I mean, these were religious obligations and responsibilities, caring for the poor, the widow, the orphan, the stranger, was a religious expectation and command. So I think in that regard, that there can be a lot of, there are affinities between hip hop's expression of the struggles of marginalized groups. And but at the same time, with all that said, I think one of the things I start off with in the introduction is that there's a tension in hip hop studies between those that speak of hip hop, as I have just emphasized, the elements of social consciousness, the social commentary. I think that there's some that really want to emphasize the importance of hip hop for social issues, social justice. And on the other hand, those that say, no, it's really not about primarily about social justice. It's about pleasure. It's about the beauty of the music. It's about rhyme schemes. It's about joy. It's about dance. Like reggaeton tends to be dance centric. It's not typically very heavy on like social issues. And so I think there is that tension in hip hop studies, and in hip hop itself, of artists that are more frivolous with their rhymes, or, you know, again, it's more party centric. And then of course there's other artists that are speaking about issues that reflect some of the concerns of the day. And I think hip hop has both, and that there's room for both.
Right. And it's not mutually exclusive. Also, I think like part of that sensuality or taking part in the joy of hip hop can also be a radical experience.
I love that. That's exactly what I was trying to convey, is that, like, again, to use when I talk about reggaeton in the later chapters, of it's not always, you know, again, I don't think you could reduce music in general to just the lyrics. You know, music is obviously so much more than the lyrics. And again, that's another complaint I have with a lot of academic approaches to music, is thinking that you could just quote these words and it exhausts the meaning of a particular song. I mean, these are song lyrics. So it's like you have to understand the music and the dance. So with like reggaeton, I think I use this expression, defiance through celebration. So I think there's defiance through celebration, through dance, through the loud banging beats themselves can be meaningful. And I mean, basically these young kids saying that we're here, we're present, you know, and that kind of rending rendering themselves visible is essential to it. And you're so right. It's not always just like in the socially conscious lyricism.
It's interesting because it seems like such a different experience of religion itself. Like worship, there's like a trend of like, I think you call it like middle class or suburban white middle class Christianity or Catholicism that's worship. It's worship with, it's without rhythm. It's without like so much song. The point is transcendence into another sphere rather than music that's going to bring you to where you are bodily.
Yes. Yes.
Is it just a different experience of religion that music's informing, this type of music?
Yes. So, again, when I get to the chapters on reggaeton, I specifically turn to the issue of dance more specifically, because I think you're so right that religion in general has typically been suspicious of dance. That's not always true in other religious traditions. Like I love some of the stories of in Hinduism and in Indian religious traditions where, you know, the gods are portrayed as dancing, but you don't see that much in the Jewish and Christian and Islamic traditions. There's greater suspicion of dance. It's connected to the body. It's connected to sexuality. And so, especially if you look at like the history of American Protestantism, there was like fears of dance, going back to rock and roll, gyrating hips and all that kind of sexuality. It was also racialized. So there was a lot of that associations, not only with the body, but it was seen as associated with Black traditions. And so there's, it's connected to, of course, racism. And so, yeah, generally speaking, in Christianity, and I think that generally holds true for Catholicism as well, that the music was very ethereal and supposed to put you in a mood of meditation, but it never, ever rocked the body. I mean, it never moves the body. And unless, again, think of the Black church, like obviously where it's much more sensual, much more bodily, much more joyful. And that issue of, again, the suspicion of religious traditions towards dance, the body, and sexuality are deeply connected in that regard. And I think obviously hip hop and music in general is, it kind of expands the horizon of allowing us to see and experience transcendence in various ways that it doesn't need to be confined to a church setting, a church ritual, a church ceremony, that there's ways. And so that's why I invoke at the beginning, St. Ignatius of Loyola, the very simple notion that God is in all things. It was one of his maxims. And I think that's an important insight. And the book kind of follows that idea that that God can be in all things, including the culture of hip-hop.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That reminds me of something that William James wrote about pluralism, or pluralistic pantheism, he called it, which is not obviously what we're talking about right now. But he does critique monotheism for alienating us from God, or from the idea, or from the divine, really. Because if we're thinking of God as something infinite and something apart from us, we can't really take any meaningful part in it, because we're corporeal beings. We're not infinite. We're here on this earth. So I think that talking about music within hip hop this way makes it seem like a really interesting way to connect us with that kind of infinitude, in that, like, through the music we can be both anchored to the earth and also we can be, you know, connected with the divine.
Yeah, I think, I guess to put it really simply, that there's this typical tension in religious traditions between what's called transcendence and immanence. You know, God's presence in the earth, God's presence in the rivers and trees and lakes and animals and in each other. And typically that's the sense of immanence is also what Christianity is understood by incarnation. So being taking flesh. But unfortunately, I mean, I think Christianity acknowledges God taking flesh in the figure of Jesus, but and in creation. If you read especially the history of Catholic theology, there's a strong emphasis on God's presence in creation, like St. Francis of Assisi or something, who saw God in animals and, you know, brother, sun, sister, moon. But again, the typically not fully in the human body. And again, dance in particular, that there was always this suspicion of dance is associated with sexuality. And that's one of the, I think, unfortunate biases of Christian theology, of like this distrust of the body and dance and sexuality. Now, I do point out, like, in a lot of Latin American cultures, like I mentioned, in Cuba in particular, there were hundreds and hundreds of dances in these cultures, in Latin American cultures. So, and they were Catholic cultures. So, but I guess what I'm saying is that it was always marginalized from the religious there was religious festivities where dance would have been part of those religious celebrations. But it certainly wasn't incorporated, generally speaking, into the rituals, like into the mass, for example. So yeah, it's an interesting issue of like how Christianity and why Christianity developed such pejorative connotations of like the body and sexuality.
Right.
But that's beyond the scope of my book.
But it does seem like you're talking about how hip hop is overcoming that. And like, especially in the chapter on Kendrick Lamar, I remember you say that he's not interested in that God. He's not interested in that God of white supremacy. And he's interested in a black Jesus, one that can deal with the human and the immediate.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was getting at with Kendrick Lamar, and obviously he uses it metaphorically, of course, but But for him, God's blackness is something like, you know, the identification of God with the struggles of marginalized groups. And that, and I think that's true to Christianity, that Jesus embraces the outcasts of society. And yet, a lot of times Christianity has privileged the insiders, the powerful, and especially, you know, European forms of Christianity. And so I think that there's a long tradition in hip hop. Tupac, for example, spoke of a black Jesus. That obviously goes back before hip hop, of course. And that, you know, wants to kind of reframe our understanding of God through a different lens and looking at it through different non-European experiences and symbol, non-European symbols and images. And again, the point is not, which a lot of critics of wokeism this day, it's very popular to bash wokeism, but I think what people are arguing for is not necessarily to jettison all European conceptions of God or Christianity. All people are arguing for is inclusion, like to be more broader, to include different human experiences into our idea of God. I think really ultimately the trends of that term wokeism, like literally what it means is being wakeful, being aware, being socially aware, and believing that the United States needs to grapple with the history of racism and that we need to have a racial, as people have said recently, like a reckoning with race. And I think the critics of so-called wokeism are basically arguing that we don't need a racial reckoning. there aren't problems of racism in the history of our country. And, because I do point out at the outset of the book that that there is always those like swings in hip hop, and not just hip hop, but in music in general, or in art, the studies of art, like is art just for art for art's sake, or should it be something more meaningful? And I said that in hip hop, you have these like ebbs and flows. You have pendulum swings where sometimes it's just escapist, where it's just like somebody like Biggie, he was like a master at like his rhyme schemes and his flow and his voice, like the baritone voice. He was just such a master with rapping, with the art of emceeing. And he was, again, he's not necessarily talking about social issues. So there's aspects of where hip hop can be escapist. Like sometimes we need relief from the struggles of the day. But there's pendulum swings. And then I think around 2010, maybe, the pendulum started swinging and you start seeing an uprising in voices that want a meaningful content. In other words, like combining, somebody once says, both the music and the meaning. Like, so I think from 2010 on, there was a stronger sense of like, people want more meaningful messages and more inclusive that include different experiences that are more maybe gender bending. And you see this in like reggaeton and like Bad Bunny, who is like in the Met Gala. I mean, he typically likes to play with gender. And so I think people want more meaningful content and are tired of like the hip hop that is only like is misogynistic and, you know, can be anti-gay. And, you know, that I think for good reasons has been called into question.
Right. I think Kendrick is someone who is really good at bridging both of those things. Like, he's just so musically rich, but also just lyrically, like, insane. And I also wanted to talk about how, like, religion in Kendrick's music is so, like, multifaceted and so complex. There are a lot of different layers to it, I found. Like, from what you were saying, he's my favorite artist ever, so I've been listening to him forever, but I just heard so many new things after reading your book. Like, one layer being that there are biblical metaphors and symbolism. Like, you talk about how he uses water in his song Thirst and fire in The Blacker the Berry. Then there are also biblical figures directly discussed, like Lucifer. He talks about Lucy, angels, and the Messiah. And then you also have the sonic quality of the music itself, which is spiritual and jazzy in and of itself, but also really intense and like bass heavy at times. It can be both guttural and transcendent. So I would love to discuss all of those layers, starting with the metaphors. Like, what are some of the metaphors you notice in his music?
There's so much richness there. And so I'll give you a couple. One that's a little more explicit is the one you just invoked, Sing About Me, I'm Dying of Thirst, where Kendrick Lamar makes it clear that for him, it's about baptism. And so we know that between the mixtapes of Kendrick Lamar's when he was still in his teens, he was already really prolific. He was just like, he released many mixtapes before Good Kid, Mad City. But if you listen to him, he's like still searching for his voice. I mean, naturally, he was really young. But somewhere between his mixtapes and Good Kid, Mad City in 2012, he, in his own, this is not my view of things, he got religion. You know, he had a religious conversion where he became more intensely Christian. And a song like Sing About Me, I'm Dying of Thirst, I think what's remarkable about Kendrick is he also addresses that, like, hip hop in the past has addressed a lot of social issues, but he's also addressing like spiritual needs. And I think that's pretty remarkable in the culture of hip hop, of that he sees a lot of the youth of his generation and younger needing things more than just material possessions, and that there are deeper desires in the human, that the human spirit yearns for. And that's kind of what a lot of his music. So I think, you know, he says explicitly that Sing About Me, the I'm Dying of Thirst is the waters of baptism. And so has a lot of biblical images of connecting with John's gospel of the symbolism of water in there. But let me jump to another, my favorite metaphor in To Pimp a Butterfly is, of course, the butterfly metaphor, because it's particularly relevant for religious traditions since the butterfly is often a symbol of the soul. And it's such a beautiful image that that Kendrick Lamar plays with on To Pimp a Butterfly is the transformation of the caterpillar from, you know, this early larvae stage into the caterpillar, into eventually a butterfly who can soar into the skies. And I think, of course, it's a symbol of transformation, a religious, of kind of a spiritual transformation. And he's like intent on chronicling that in so much from, again, Good Kid is about, you know, the life of this kid growing up in Compton and trying to survive the streets. But it's also about his growing consciousness and a growing spiritual transformation. And I, so I love the metaphor of the butterfly. And I guess you could see also in To Pimp a Butterfly is where he uses a stronger jazz aesthetic, of course. Whereas in Damn is much more of like a Southern influence. Trap beats are a stronger, it's more of a booming aesthetic in Damn. Whereas To Pimp a Butterfly is more avant-garde, it's more creative. So I say that, you know, it's for people to have more sophisticated tastes for music, which is why it wasn't necessarily like the kind of music for radio play as much as like Good Kid and Damn was. So, and I'm really excited to see what happens with his new album that's supposed to come out soon. So those are two of my favorite metaphors, but it's really about, you know, so much of that is he's telling a story about his transformation as an artist and as a person, and as somebody who undergoes a spiritual transformation and embraces Christianity.
Have you seen his new music video?
No, I haven't. What did you think?
It was really cool.
Oh, it's the heart part.
Part four, five, yeah.
Part five, okay.
There's a lot. It was crazy. It was like they used deep cuts, deep fakes, I mean.
Oh yeah. I think I read something that that he appears as different characters.
Yeah. As Kanye, Will Smith, Nipsey Hussle, a bunch of people. I'm curious to hear what you think after you see it.
Yeah.
And what do you hope to see in this new album coming out? What do you think it's going to be like?
God, I'm super excited about it. I don't know what to expect. Like, I was looking at... I remember just yesterday I was like flipping through something, just looking at some of the lyrics that appear in the heart part four and five. And I think, you know, that Kendrick is Kendrick and he's going to always be, I think he's going to give us always extraordinarily thoughtful lyricism and masterful, like, rhyme schemes, and he switches personas. And actually, that's a good example of that, where, you know, he likes to, which makes it really difficult. When we talk about it in my classes, it's like, is he speaking for himself or is he embodying a different person? There's so much of that where he loves putting on masks and playing different characters. So that's why it's very dramatic. It's very theatrical. Because he's playing, he's an actor. He's playing different characters and giving voice to different experiences. So I think, you know, we're going to get all of that. I'm most interested in seeing like the production side, like what the production is going to be like, the music itself. Did you find it compelling? Again, I haven't listen to it carefully yet. I've been swamped with final exams but did you find the music itself compelling?
I did. I thought it reminded me more of To Pimp a Butterfly than Damn.
Oh, okay.
And To Pimp a Butterfly is my favorite of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. I love it too. So all right. Well, that's good to hear. I'm excited to sit down with it.
Yeah. I don't know if that song is part of the album, but it was great. All right. So my final question is, what's next for you? Are you working on anything following up this, taking a break after this book comes out?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in many ways, I'm still, I still teach this class on hip hop and religion. And there's just so many different dimensions of hip hop that, and I think that the thing that's interesting about pop music in general these days is how fast it changes. And I think the culture that we live in is always obsessed with the new, like the fresh, like who's coming out next, and which can be problematic too. Because I mean, if you're an artist, I could see the pressure. No wonder there's so much like issues of anxiety and sometimes depression. And again, that's another theme I mentioned in the book, and we discuss in my classes, of just like this generation of like struggling with these mental health. And you see it in a lot of the artists as well, especially ones that have died too young, you know, drug overdoses. But I guess I'm saying that a lot of those issues is this feeling of like this overwhelming pressure to constantly come up with something new.
Right.
And you're forgotten, you know, in 6 months or less sometimes. Like, if it's last month, you're already like the old thing, and we're looking for something new and fresh. So
it's crazy. And you're not even making money anymore from like selling records. You have to then go and perform forever.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
There's that issue of like, you've got to be doing the concerts and all of that. So there is definitely a lot of pressure. It's always changing, which also can make it exciting that there's always new voices. I think what we're going to see a lot more of, and I mentioned this in the later chapters of like, more reggaeton, more Latino voices, I think are going to be part of the future of hip hop. So I'm excited to see how that develops. I'm also, and this is now really switching beyond hip hop, but I've was born and raised in the desert regions of Arizona. And I'm really interested in the notion of the desert and as it connects to migration. You have still the presence of people coming up across the desert, often dying in the desert on that trek. That still happens a lot. And so the image of the desert, of course, is a crucial symbol in the biblical tradition. So I'm kind of interested in the symbol of the desert and as it connects to migration. So I might move in that direction. But I would say that hip hop is always going to be an interest of mine.
Well, I'm excited to see what's next. Yeah.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the invitation, Frances. And
of course. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. Of course. Thank you.